Со двора подъезд известный под названием «Черный ход». В том подъезде, как в поместье, проживает черный кот. Он в усы усмешку прячет, темнота ему как щит. Все коты поют и плачут.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sean Guillory. Every podcast, I talk to an author about a new book on Russia or Eurasia. In this episode, I spoke with Jan Plamper about his book, The Stalin Cult, A Study in the Alchemy of Power. Jan Plamper begins his book with an illuminating anecdote that demonstrates the power and scope of Stalin's personality cult. The story comes from Artyom Sergeyev, Stalin's adopted son. Sergeyev recalled one night when Stalin learned that his biological son, Vasily, used his famous name to escape punishment from one of his drunken binges. In response to Stalin's rage, Vasily said, "But I'm a Stalin too." "No, you're not," Stalin rebuffed. "You're not Stalin, and I'm not Stalin. Stalin is Soviet power. Stalin is what he is in the newspapers and the portraits, not you, not even me." The production of the Stalin personality cult that disembodied the man and turned him into a symbol of Soviet power is at the center of Plamper's text. At the heart of this cult was Stalin's image, which was reproduced in a variety of media, including portraiture and film. But the crafting, production, and canonization of Stalin's image was no simple endeavor. It involved technologies that gave Stalin's cult a particularly modern flavor. As Plamper shows, the production and dissemination of Stalin's cult involved an entire institutional apparatus, including mass media, artistic unions, art criticism, artistic competitions, individual filters, particularly Stalin's secretaries, and art patrons like Defense Minister Klement Voroshilov, on top of which stood Stalin at the apex. As for Stalin's personal role, Plamper finds that it is best to view Stalin's relationship to his cult as a form of immodest modesty. Stalin wanted his own cult and meticulously controlled it. At the same time, he purposely disavowed it. And through this alchemy of institutional and individual power did Stalin's personality cult penetrate the psyche of the citizenry. For more on Stalin's cult, here's my interview with Jan. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Sean.
Welcome to New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies. Thanks for taking the time to join me to talk about your book, The Stalin Cult, A Study in the Alchemy of Power.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Absolutely. So just to get started, why don't you tell me about yourself and how you came to write a book about the Stalin cult?
Well, I grew up in the southwest of what was then West Germany in a small university town. And I think for a kid growing up in the 80s or coming of age in the 80s, in that kind of setting, there were probably four pathways to the Russia bug, to getting infected by things Russian. One was biographical, family background. The other was political, leftist politics. Third was perestroika, and the fourth was Russian literature. And for me, it was leftist politics, Russian literature, and perestroika.
Oh, okay.
So that's how I got started. Then I went off to college in the United States on a scholarship to Brandeis University, where I had the good fortune to study with Gregory Fries, who really introduced me to Russian history and to archival work as well, and the importance of archival work. And after that, I went off to Russia. This was 1992 to do a peace service in lieu of my German military service. And I worked for the anti-Stalinist grassroots organization Memorial in St. Petersburg. Yes, I did social work with four elderly ladies, all of them victims of Stalinism and Nazism. And that was for 18 months, and it was of course formative. It was very important for me. And after that, I stayed on for another year and started working in the archives. They just opened, and deferred graduate school. Entered graduate school in 1995. Went to UC Berkeley, where I started this dissertation on the Stalin cult. I knew I was going to do a dissertation on the Stalin cult before I'd read Ian Kershaw's book on the Hitler myth. That had deeply impressed me. And there were a couple of other things that came together why I got interested in the Stalin cult. I think it had to do with what I perceived as a general shift from program to images, to packaging in Western politics, 80s, the Reagan years. It also had to do with early 90s, getting to know the new cultural history, the general interest in representations and symbols, rituals, and the visual turn, of course, the turn to images as important sources and legitimate sources for historians. I think all of this came together. And so I started studying at Berkeley, and this was a wonderful time. I thought I was at the right place at the right time in St. Petersburg between 1992 and 1995, and I felt the same way at Berkeley between 1995 and 1999, which is when I went off to the archives. So I studied under Yuri Slyoskin, who was my main advisor. Reggie Zelnick was my second reader. And I had two outside readers, Vicky Bunnell and Irina Papirna, who was extremely important and continues to be important, had a formative influence. And it was a great group and a great cohort of people, and you could really find your niche. This was a good time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then so, I went off to...
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I went off to the archives, 1999, 2000, and then wrote the actual dissertation in Berlin, and then revised it to book, and it just appeared.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have this great complementary lineage of actually working with Memorial, which I imagine really kind of colored seeing the real effects of Stalinism on people that you knew, and then, of course, being in Berkeley, which Slyoskin is I can imagine, intellectually formative. So I can see how those two complemented this work.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Well, you begin the book by giving a kind of broad sweep of defining what modern personality cult is. If you could talk about that, what a modern personality cult is, and how does it differ from other cults of personality?
Right, I draw a line between modern personality cults and pre-modern personality cults. And I make the argument that there are really five features that typify a modern personality cult, and that Napoleon III was the first instantiation of a modern personality cult. The first feature is that they're products of mass politics. They're directed at the entire population. They derive legitimacy from the entire population, not just some small group, some elite group, such as the aristocracy. The second feature is that they all employ the mass media. So they could reach everyone, the entire population, through mass media. And they're also potentially uniformly readable by the population, which has... which has acquired cultural techniques that are necessary for this through universal schooling, mass conscription, that kind of thing. The third feature is that they're all parts of closed societies. So there's a circumscribed public space which doesn't allow for the introduction of a rival cult, for example. The fourth to me is that they're all children of a secular age. There's no such thing as divine right. That is, there's no metaphysical reference that endows the leader with legitimacy. There's also no reference to God inscribed in the body of the leader. There's no such thing as divisions of the leader's body, as we know from Kantorowicz. So the body always represents a totality of society. So the key thing here is secular and populist sovereignty. And the fifth and final feature is that they're all really male. That is, the cult objects are always men. There are no queens, no tsaritsas.
Now, I'm kind of curious because a lot of people have said, in especially in the Russian context, that some of these, there's a tradition of iconography, and which is very religious based in Russian Orthodoxy, and all of the portraits of Lenin and portraits of Stalin is a continuation of that. So how would you account for the kind of lineages of the past kind of moving into this modern personality cult?
For a long time, I thought that the concepts of political theology and political religion were very attractive. But when you look at it more closely, you realize that if you use these concepts, you won't really capture the specificity of a cult such as Stalin's. That is, true, Stalin portraits were often hung in a corner of the apartment where earlier icons had hung. True, certain colors had the same kind of symbolic valence that we know from Orthodox iconography. True, some of the words that, say, the painters of these Stalin portraits used are words that resurfaced from the language of Russian Orthodox iconography. But, for example, you're never going to be able to capture the feature of Stalin's gaze, which is always directed at a point outside the picture. This is not be typical for icons. This can only be understood if you know something about Marxism. Stalin's gaze is directed to a focal toward a focal point outside the picture because he embodies a Hegelian kind of world spirit. He knows where the future is. He knows he can actually gaze into communism, into utopia. The production methods will be much more difficult to capture with concepts from political theology and political religion. This is why I decided to use a mixture of concepts. Some of them drawn from a sociologist, Edward Shields, who argues that the center of society is always endowed with sacrality, sacredness. I also call it sacral aura. And a number of other things. That, to me, proved more productive than political religion concepts and direct kinds of comparisons with iconography.
Yeah, I find it interesting that you draw a very, going through, say, the showing of the Tsar in Nicholas II in particular, but really after the revolution with Lenin than more with Stalin, you have this break that makes it really distinct from, saying, a continuation. And I found that a very compelling way to look at it. So going in line with the mass media, you give an enormous importance to Pravda in forming the Stalin cult. Why is Pravda so central?
I wish I could have worked through a lot more newspapers, but there are limitations of time and space. I did look through all of Pravda from 1928 to 1954, which was quite a bit of work, and I do the statistics of it as well. They're in an appendix at the end. But Pravda was of course very important. It was the central newspaper. It was highly controlled by Stalin himself. It was a kind of compass for various people, among them the painters who actually produced the Stalin portraits in order to follow the party line. Pravda was also the place where some of the templates for Stalin portraits, photographic templates, were introduced. Some of the photographs that were published in Pravda were then distributed among painters, and they were supposed to paint their Stalin portraits from these photographs. But most important, to me, it's a kind of vehicle to really get at the changes in the representations, the visual representations of Stalin over time. And there's nothing better than a newspaper like Pravda. So, I looked at it through all of this period, and I identified the kind of high points and the low points of Stalin in the newspaper. So you can see, for example, that it all starts with a kind of big bang with his 50th birthday in December 1929. But then, interestingly, there's a hiatus, and he only really reappears in mid-1933. And one can speculate why that is the case, why he was not shown in the newspaper between 29 and 1933. One of the arguments is that that they did not want to associate him with the awful effects of collectivization. There are other arguments as well. But it really takes off in mid-1933 and until the high point of his 60th birthday in 1939, the newspaper is preoccupied with canonizing Stalin, with showing that he is number one, and with introducing a set of stock images for the leader. And they're specific. You can look at the specific strategies that the newspaper uses to set Stalin off from his comrades in arms. So, for example, he's shown in white, in a white uniform, even though at that time he probably was not wearing white uniforms. If other people were shown in dark uniforms, his name is shown first, mentioned first in the caption. Everybody in the presidium touches their face. He does not. His gaze is directed at a focal point outside the pictures. Other people's gazes are not, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought this was an interesting couple of things that you note is when Stalin doesn't appear. So you also say during the terror, too, that his image goes down, and then also during the war, and they have various speculation as to why. But also this idea of Stalin in white, which, as you said, he's wearing dark clothes, and they probably just kind of, at one point, you say, pasted in a picture of him in white because the way he looks is quite unnatural, really to distinguish him out from the rest of his entourage. You also argue that Stalin's spatial arrangement in photos and paintings had great symbolic importance. Why did Stalin's place in images matter?
Stalin represented a phase in the history of the Soviet Union where a certain place had been reached in the timeline that was communism. Stalin represented, especially with the promulgation of the Stalin Constitution of 1936, represented a certain arrival in communism. And so if Lenin represented the revolution, this really shows in his pictorial representations. Lenin's body is always moving outward, forward. There's usually a hand gesture that moves moves away. There's the raised hand that we all know. This is typical for Lenin and the revolution. For Stalin, Stalin is the center of concentric circles that are built around him, and you can see this in a number of pictures where really Stalin embodies the center of these concentric circles. And it's only his gaze that leads out of this center, his gaze that is directed towards the future of communism. And we have verbal examples where both the painters and critics interpret his gaze in precisely this way. So that's the typical representation of Stalin in pictures. It's also a verbal representation. If you look at the short course of the Bolshevik Party, you notice that the construction of the party history, is represented as the gathering of circles. It starts with a smaller circle, a Marxist circle, and then other circles are added on. And I use probably the most famous Stalin painting, Stalin and Vorashilov in the Kremlin, 1938, painted by the star painter of the 1930s, Alexander Gerasimov. I use that painting in order to illustrate this point and to show how that painting is organized in circles, concentric circles, around the central figure of Stalin.
And talk about that painting a little bit more, because you also go into the way the painting reflects the actual city of Moscow itself as centers of power in relationship to other potential monuments like the Palace of Soviets, but other architectural or places in the city.
One of the interesting features of that painting is that the balustrade behind Stalin and Voroshilov is broken at one point. And you can see that this is most certainly done in order to create a visual axis between the two leaders and the people who are gathered on the Moscow embankment on the other side of the river Moskva. They're demonstrating. It's probably some May Day demonstration or some kind of demonstration. This is done, I argue, in order to create a connecting axis between the people, the Narod, and the leaders. Then you can see that there are smokestacks in another circle behind this group of people on the embankment of the river Moskva, and only behind that in another, in yet another concentric circle can you see the cupolas of an old Russian Orthodox church. So one could argue that this is the old Russia that has been overcome. There are many different readings that are possible. One of the readings is that Stalin's gaze in this painting is actually directed towards the Palace of Soviets, which was never built, and that the Palace of Soviets was supposed to feature a statue, a huge statue of Lenin. The palace was supposed to be higher than the Empire State Building, and so one could say that the continuer's gaze is directed toward the founder, Lenin. So the continuer of Lenin's cause looks back towards the founding moment. One could also argue that there is a visual axis continuing from the Palace of Soviets onto a monument that was going to be built, the monument of the Stalinist Constitution, 1936 Constitution. And that way, his gaze becomes more auto-referential because it's a moment, of course, that he created. It was his constitution, or represented as such.
Yeah, I thought that your analysis, this kind of thick description of this painting and all the elements in it and how they relate to even, you know, monuments, even things outside the painting, was actually quite interesting. So thanks for the elaboration on that. One of the questions that people always have, and including myself, is Stalin's personal relationship to this cult. You know, how did he feel about it? What did he think about it? How did he control it? So if you could talk a bit about Stalin's relationship, his personal relationship with this cult, and in particular, how did he control it?
So the public representation of Stalin's relationship to his own cult was one of grudging tolerance. He had to tolerate this cult because the people truly loved him, and Soviet Russia was the first truly democratic society since the people loved him, since legitimacy rested with the people. He had to accept this cult. But when you look closer, you notice very quickly that in a polity such as the Soviet Union, no phenomenon of the dimensions of the Stalin cult could have ever existed without his acceptance. So this public representation of him tolerating the cult grudgingly was really deployed in order to overcome the paradox of a personality cult in a polity that claimed to be implementing a collectivist ideology. The Stalin cult was an oxymoron, and it never really quite got out of this paradox. There were the Hitler cult, the cult of the Duce, Mussolini. They really had no qualms about being cults. There were no ideological barriers to these cults, with the Führer principle and the theory, the Nietzschean theory of the super man. There was really no problem with that. And that shows, by the way, should say this parenthetically, in the archival situation, you know, for the Hitler cult, as far as we know, there are central archives. There's the archive of the Ministry of Propaganda of Goebbels' ministry that's important. So it was the archival documents were deposited in a central place. There's no such thing for the Stalin cult. There's no archival collection named Stalin cult. They're scattered all over the place, and often they're hidden, and it's quite difficult
interrupt, I mean, one of the interesting things you point out is that there's actually – the archive is split in this respect, where there is – in Stalin's personal archive there that's been available, there is material that have been collected, in some cases even falsified, for his biography that was never written but planned to be written. And then everything else, the other stuff that shows Stalin's more, you know, being okay with his cult, comes from the presidential archive. So you have this kind of interesting purposeful split in the archive, if you can talk a little bit about that too.
Yes, exactly. It's a very interesting story. So the Stalin archive at the Central Party Archive, Ergaspi, in Moscow, Stalin depository is called 558, Fond 558, is split in different parts. And if you first look at it, there are all kinds of documents, in, if you will, in the upper reaches of the archive. When you start your excavation, your archaeological excavation, the upper reaches, you encounter documents where Stalin actually protests his cult. Somebody suggests to write a children's book about Stalin. He says no. There's a movie scenario where he's supposed to be at the head of some kind of demonstration. No, he crosses himself out and so on. But then there is another part of the archive, the famous Opus 11 that had been sent to the presidential archive during the coup d'etat of August 1991. Which just was returned during the 1990s and opened to researchers in 2000. This Opus 11 actually shows that Stalin did control his cult, that he was the mastermind, that he was the Archimedean point. There were, of course, various institutions that participated in the making of the cult, but they were always directed toward Stalin, ostensibly his secretariat, but there are some instances that show, or that at least make it very probable that some of the cult products moved to Stalin's desk as well.
Mm-hmm. And how did he, I mean, one of the things you talk about is this kind of filtering process where that it involves his subordinates, his secretary, and then in some cases Stalin himself personally approving the use of certain images and photographs. What role did these filters play in creating the cult?
Well, they were important for the canonization of new images. So you have to imagine this cult was a phenomenon of enormous proportions. And there was a semi-autonomously functioning system of this cult, very complex system, but it functioned semi-autonomously. It involved all kinds of organizations, institutions. It involved the artist associations. It involved associations, censorship boards, the secret police, the publishing outlets, visual factories, Isa Kombinata, and so on. But when a new representation of Stalin was introduced, it often had to go up to the very pinnacle of power. And there are some instances where we find, there's one instance where one of his secretaries writes to an editor of a newspaper who had asked whether a certain new Stalin representation could be published in the newspaper, where that, secretary gets asked, show it to Stalin. He's actually saying, show it to Stalin, please. And he answers, he's against it. So don't publish it. Later, after the war, I discovered that there was a more regularized system. There was actually a number of portraits or posters were sent to the secretariat, and then they just added pluses or minuses or what to change and so on. But so the secretariat, and most certainly Stalin.
And but another thing too, you talk about too, which I found quite interesting, is patron client networks that were integral to the cultural production of Stalin. In particular, the very vital role of Klement Voroshilov. Talk about his role as a patron of the arts.
Absolutely, Voroshilov is crucial. Voroshilov's interest in the arts goes back to the Civil War, when he was a Civil War general, and there were paintings that were done, portraits that were done of Civil War generals during the Civil War, and these generals were actually able to distribute rare resources such as painting materials and so on, sometimes food, to the artists. And he was also important in the commission for the memorialization of the memory of Lenin. After Lenin's death, that was set up and ended up planning the mausoleum. So he had some experience in that kind of cult building. Lenin cult being another important kind of milestone on the path towards the Stalin cult. And he became an important patron of painters in the realist tradition. He became personal friends with them. He actually collected paintings. He had an entire collection of Передвижник wanderer paintings and contemporary socialist realist paintings that burnt because his grandson after the war played with matches.
Oh, geez.
This is something I discovered in his wife's, Екатерина Ворошилова's diary. And he was very important in the Stalin cult, so he would broker access. He would broker access to Stalin, who could only be painted at public, on public occasions. When he would give a speech in the Bolshoi, for example, this was really the only time that painters could produce new sketches of Stalin. Because he would not sit, he would not model. We know that he did model in the 1920s, before he really came to power. There's a famous Stalin drawing of 1922 by Nikolai Andreev, and we also know that he sat for a sculptor by the name of Marina Rinzunska in 1926, but as far as I was able to figure out, he never really sat again during the 1930s. And many other high Bolsheviks, high-ranking Bolsheviks, didn't sit either because Bolsheviks do not model. Modeling is frivolous. It's something that you don't do. It's not in sync with the values of a true Bolshevik. And so the only occasion was really to get privileged access when he was when he gave a speech or some such. Another thing that they did, they would hire so-called sitters, naturshiki, people who shared his height, who shared Stalin's height, who sometimes looked similar, who could at least put on his clothes. So we know, I know, for example, from interview with Alexander Gerasimov's son-in-law, Vladilen Shabernikov, that Shabernikov claims that he sat for Stalin and that he actually wore his overcoat, which they got from the Kremlin, and used his pipe and so on. They got these props from the Kremlin. But this is something that did not enter public discourse during this time.
And in addition to individuals, of course, you also, and you mentioned this a little while ago, the very important role institutions play in crafting the Stalin canon. I mean, artist institutions, educational, publishing houses, and also police, the secret police. Talk a bit about how the practices of these institutions created the canon of Stalin.
Okay, well, it's a very complex, it's a maze. It's really a maze that's very difficult to cut through. I tried to do that in the fifth chapter. So there were certain, practices that are art Soviets that would discuss paintings and that would often invite a painter and give him concrete instructions how to change his painting. And I have I was able to find the protocols of some of these art Soviet discussions of certain paintings. And they, to me, are really, they go to the heart of socialist realism. They go to the heart of portraying the leader. This is socialist realism in practice, in situ. You know, socialist realism, there's a big discussion of what socialist realism actually was, whether it was a set of doctrines, whether it was a style. To me, it's precisely these kinds of practices that actually made up socialist realism. So you'll find a discussion of a painting by a painter, a not well-known painter, an obscure painter by the name of Yeroshev, a painting about Lenin's funeral. And you'll have famous artists in the Art Soviet actually explaining to this painter, he's present, why he didn't execute this painting the way he was supposed to. For example, it was connected. They were unhappy with the size of the various leaders and the place of Stalin in this picture. It was entirely clear to them that this should not be a mimetic representation of what actually happened or what Yeroshev thought that actually happened, but it should represent the quasi-dynastic progression of the world spirit from Lenin's body to Stalin's body, and that had to be expressed in this painting. And that's how they explicated it to him. Portrait competitions were very important, especially in the early phase of the Stalin cult in the early 1930s, when the canon was still forming. There were portrait competitions organized by publishing houses or by artist institutions, and well-known painters would be invited personally, but there was also an open competition in the newspaper for cultural workers, Sovetskoye Iskustvo, that most of them read. And there was a prize that we could win. In later years, this became a less important way of producing portraits.
What about the police? How did they play a role?
Well, the police was always present. In artist lore, everyone knew who was an informer. And the police, there are some cases in which the police punished painters who created representations that of Stalin that were deemed or other leaders that were deemed heterodox. So there's the a case of one painter who painted the funeral of Kirov, and he was accused of showing a skull that supposedly shown that one was supposedly to discern through the paper. It's shown through the actual painting. So there was a kind of overinterpretation, especially during the years of the terror, of these images. This is, of course, a very, very sensitive matter.
Yeah, and it seems that it through all of these institutions is kind of like a creation of an ethics of representing Stalin through these discussions and kind of disciplining one another and critiquing one another to really, by what would you say, the war, or even somewhat after the war, you get a very hard canon as how Stalin is supposed to be represented.
Right. During the war at first, in places like Pravda, Stalin representations get noticeably scaled back, and he only really returns towards the end of the war when victory is certain, and you have a different kind of Stalin who returns. It's a Stalin who has gray hair, his generalissimo uniform, the white parade uniform after the war, and you also get what I call absent representations. So you have representations in which he's only present on the enlightened, enthused faces of listeners who are sitting in front of a radio receiver, for example, or on the faces of young boys who are returning from a Stalin from a demonstration, and also, as you say, the canon was really became quite the canon became an almost ossified, you get an almost ossified kind of canon, and you also notice this in art criticism. So a number of what they call obrazy, images, develops Stalin as father of peoples, for example, or Stalin as the builder of communism, строитель коммунизма, or Stalin as the post-war generalissimo. And for each of these obrazy, for each of these verbal designations, you get a set of visual attributes that are always shown in connection with these. So the father of people is always shown with ethnic minorities. The builder of communism, строитель коммунизма, always with the factories, the tractors of the first year, 5-year plan. The post-war generalissimo always in his white uniform. In fact, you have art historical dissertations, кандидатские диссертации, doctoral dissertations that are written at this time, often by the painters themselves and by the sculptors themselves, that consist of nothing but a short kind of explication of one of these образы, so a kind of enumeration of these attributes, nothing more.
The other big question, too, is how did the public respond to this? And you dwell on this in one of the chapters, how people responded to expositions of Stalin's image and what they wrote in these commemorative books. Talk a bit about how it was recepted by the public.
Well, I do have some methodological doubts about actually being able to reconstruct how the public received the cult of Stalin. Other people do too. And so what I actually try to reconstruct the ways in which the producers of the cult try to ascertain how people reacted to the paintings and how these public reactions to the cult were included in the actual cult production as a kind of feedback loop. So, for example, I found these comment books from some of the Stalin exhibits where people left comments about the paintings they encountered. And rather than read them as a kind of face value reactions to the paintings, many of them are very formulaic, I looked at how they came to figure at artist meetings where certain art was critiqued. So, and they did figure. Some of the art functionaries and the art critics actually looked through the comment books and, as one of them put it, translated them into the numerical idiom. So he used certain words and assigned Russian grades to them, and then assigned a GPA to one or the other painter, and used this in a discussion. And this was important because, of course, this art understood itself as being from the people and for the people. This was not, and they made this point time and again, this was not bourgeois art that was only for a certain part of the people, but for the entire people. So now also trace changes in these attempts to ascertain the public's reaction to Stalin paintings. So, for example, in the beginning, comment books, книги отзывов, comment books had margins, and visitors would actually comment on visitors' comments. So one of the functions of these early comment books was to also educate visitors to an exhibit how to be cultured, культурные visitors to an exhibit, how to go to a museum. Later on, there were no such things as margins. The comment books themselves became much more, looked much more solid, leather clad, and so on. And with some of the Stalin exhibits, actually, there were no more comic books, but there were boxes in which people dropped pieces of paper. And as one of the curators of one of these Stalin exhibits told me, I was able to interview her. She said that this was in order to filter out hooligan comments on. So these comments became much more self-representational, auto-representational. But the comic books returned during the Khrushchev era, became one of the important institutions of a kind of connecting line, a kind of channel between the regime and the people during the Khrushchev era. I also examined celebrity evenings, Творческие вечера, so I found this collection of little notes, often on scrap paper, sent to the stage on which one of the actors who played Stalin, Alexei Dikhi. During these evenings, people from the audience would pass anonymous comments, questions to Dikhi, and he would then answer them. And I found some of those. And they're quite interesting. People ask, for example, why Dikhi portrays Stalin without the characteristic accent, the Georgian accent, that they were used to Gilavani, Mikhail Gilavani, who was Georgian by ethnic origin and had a thick Georgian accent, just like Stalin. And Dikhi to them was incongruous. Also, the way he moved, he moved a lot more. He was less static than Gilavani. And at the very end, in the fall of Berlin, Gilavani actually returned to the role of Stalin.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you about this, Stalin's portrayal on film, because this, of course, is a very modern aspect of the cult. And the performance of these two men and how they portrayed Stalin, and why did, say, Gilavani was the first actor and then they moved to Dikhi. And talk a bit about how they performed Stalin.
Okay, well, it's interesting. First of all, it's interesting that an actor, that actors played Stalin, right? We don't have this kind of thing for the Hitler cult, for example. Hitler is not played by actors. And one could make an argument that this is because Stalin's speaking, his speaking style, which is very kind of reserved in comparison to Hitler's, for example. Stalin's speaking style was deliberately set off against what was identified as Hitler's hysterical speaking style. You know, this is an important thing to remember, that all of these modern personality cults actually were entangled through the mass media, and they emerged entangled from the First World War. So that certain features of Stalin's, the portrayal of Stalin's body, had a latent feature in another leader in one of the other authoritarian states in Europe. And Stalin's speaking style was one of these things. And actually, Henri Barbusse, Stalin's biographer, remarks on this, that Stalin does not need this kind of bombastic, hysterical speaking style. So one could say that since his speaking style was more reserved, he was ideally suited to actually be played by an actor. Okay, and so the first Stalin movie is released in 1937, Lenin Voktibria, and it's actually Semyon Goldstab who plays Stalin in this movie. And it's only a couple of movies later that Mikhail Gilavani plays Stalin, but he in the public perception certainly becomes the celluloid Stalin. He's most easily identified with Stalin. And then after the war, we don't know why, of course, but it's very much possible that it was connected with the kind of move towards Russian nationalism in the late 40s. We see a shift to Dikhi. Dikhi would actually sat in the Gulag for an economic case, as far as we know, but he gets reactivated and he starts playing Stalin, a Russified Stalin without the Georgian accent, and less statically than Gilavani did. In the end, Gilavani returned.
Now, as we know, the Stalin cult, of course, with Stalin's death and then finally with Khrushchev's speech and then de-Stalinization in general, faded, one could say, at least officially, from Soviet and Russian consciousness. But still, one of the things that struck me when I was in Russia in 2009 was the public discourse about Stalin's image being in public. For example, during the 75th anniversary of the Moscow Metro, there was an outcry in the media, in the liberal media in particular, that one of the posters in the Metro had Stalin's image from a picture of the first Metro train. Also, during Victory Day parades, there's always a discussion about what place does Stalin play, his image play in the celebration of Victory Day. If you could talk a bit about what are the legacies of the Stalin cult in Russia?
Well, this is a huge topic, actually, and I'm not the ideal expert on this. Polly Jones wrote a dissertation and is writing a book about the legacy of the Stalin cult and about de-Stalinization. But I can say a couple of things. Certainly in post-Soviet Russia, the Stalin is one of the key battlegrounds about Russian contemporary identity, right, and its relation to the past, and it's always connected with the last remaining foundational myth of the Soviet Union, the victory in World War II, in the Great Patriotic War. And so a lot of contemporary debates actually revolve around the question of Stalin, even if they are not really connected with Stalin proper, Stalin himself. So yes, you're right. There were many instances of this kind. For example, in 2010, the Moscow mayor Lushkov gave in to a veteran group's demand to carry Stalin portraits at the annual May Day, at the annual Victory Day. I'm sorry, May 9th. Celebrations, and they were also going to put up posters of Stalin in central places in Moscow. And there was a new wave of debate about Stalin's place in Soviet history and about post-Soviet Russian identity. That's what was at stake at that time. And we now know that most certainly. This was launched in order to then sack the mayor, to sack Lushkov during the summer, which is what happened. But during that debate, there was certainly a discussion about this. In fact, the Russian edition of this book appeared just at that time in early 2010. And it was interesting to see the Russian reception. There were some people, some Democrats, who would use it and who would kind of assail contemporary Russian image politics, the representation of Putin, using that book as a kind of political argument, and there were others who would accuse me of foreign intervention, and were very unhappy about this book. So it ended up being in the center of a broader public debate that I'd never expect.
No, that's interesting. I mean, especially with the betrayal of Putin, particularly in all these very staged, masculine, photo ops of him performing all sorts of athletic and scientific feats. It really does remind, and I think it certainly does remind people of a kind of reemergence of a cult of personality or a personality cult around the image of Putin.
What this book might do, it's at least my hope, in uncovering the principle, what I call immodest modesty, that is the portrayal of Stalin's grudging tolerance for his cult, but his actual opposition to it. I think that principle will be more difficult to deploy in in the image politics of contemporary Russian politicians, including Putin. So, you know, I hope it'll be more difficult to rename a mountain after Putin through some kind of popular initiative than having Putin resist for a while, but finally give in, because after all, Russia is a democratic country.
Right, right. Well, let's hope that is the case. Let's hope that is the case. So, I mean, it's a fascinating book, and I think it does have particularly in thinking about the place of you know, all the use of personality cults in modern society in general, but also I think there's, as you say, in closed societies, and how we understand their production is really important. Just to wrap up the interview, what are you working on now?
I'm putting finishing touches on a book that will be out later this spring, early summer. It's a general introduction to the history of emotions. So I've moved to very different topics, including cultural anthropological approaches to emotions and life science, neuroscience approaches to emotions. And that book was a spin-off of a project that I started a couple of years ago. I moved back to the pre-revolutionary late Tsarist era and started working on fear among Russian soldiers, especially leading up to the First World War, and got very interested in the history of emotions, and soon discovered that there were so many theoretical, mythological problems associated with this that I had to sit down and actually get some sense about how to deal with these. This is the result of that, and after that, I'll return to my fear project. It's a project about soldierly fear.
That's great. That's something I'm interested in too. Well, great. That sounds wonderful. Well, thank you very much. It's a wonderful interview.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
I've been speaking with Jan Pampler about his book, The Stalin Cult, A Study in the Alchemy of Power. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Once again, I'm Sean Guillory, your host for New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. And if you're interested in hearing more interviews by the New Books Network, please go to newbooksnetwork.com. Until next time, goodbye. Если только пьет, грязный пол когтями тронет, как по горлу поскребет. От того-то знать не весел дом, в котором мы живем, над лампочку повесить. Денег все не соберем.